Low Orbit. Today's issue features Disassembly Required by Grayton Newman, Are You Out There by Ramoy Phillip, with music by Chris Rupolo, and The Warrior by Nathan Hall.
When assembling a piece of IKEA furniture, there's an unspoken assumption that you'll never disassemble or fix it, and instead, when you move or it falls into a state of disrepair, that it's destined for the landfill. This is frustrating because you spent money on that Calyx unit. What comes of the Billy bookcase when the particle board chips and the pegs splinter? A sadness washes across your face as you stare at a nearly empty room. You optimistically bring your screwdriver to release the shelving anchors from the wall. Obviously, you haven't had it floating against that wall for 5 years, but your drywall wasn't strong enough for the anchor screws, so who's really going to know? You gingerly pull the bookcase off of the wall, thinking to yourself that closed storage probably would have been more practical, but at some point it was too late to rectify that situation, and if not then, that point is certainly now. You're moving out, the bones of your apartment have been scraped clean, and will soon belong to a grad student at the University of Denver, your alma mater. You think about the memories you had in this now empty space when it was teeming with life. Often uninvited life of the insectoid variety, but life nonetheless.
My parents essentially built my childhood home out of then new, now vintage Acrobat modular shelving units. My dad would take me to the IKEA in San Antonio whenever visiting family because it was the closest one to New Orleans. Trips would usually take 5 or more hours long. My parents were both graphic designers trained as architects, and they love interior design, a love I would develop later in life, but I hated trips to IKEA. They loved them. One time, after the divorce, we drove back from IKEA at closing time. It was dark, and we were making the trip from Texas to Louisiana with however much IKEA my dad's Mini Cooper could accommodate. We drove through near-pitch-black expanses of the I-10 until we suddenly stopped. Traffic was too bad. Oil refineries on the horizon. We were moving at a snail's pace. Then we found the road less traveled. For good reason, it was completely dark with the exception of one lamp at the beginning of the trail. We figured any road is better than this one. So we pulled away, saying our collective goodbyes. My dad said he was sorry for this trip. I agreed. It was all but inevitable we would come across a serial killer in this, the blackest of roads, darkest of dark. We kept going and going, seemingly forever, until we spotted another highway, a mysterious road going in the right direction. So, naturally, we merged onto it. It's probably something like 3 a.m., but time meant nothing after our brush with death. We saw a subway on the side of the road, glory be. At the counter sat two very high teenagers. We informed them that there was a lot of traffic on the I-10, and they knew. They enlightened us to the fact that there had been a cucumber truck overturned on the highway, cucumbers everywhere, and traffic was stopped for miles. Suddenly, all was well. We made it home and told literally everybody about the cucumber truck.
Dear residents, We are aware that there, unfortunately, was a fire inside of the laundry facility caused by a dryer today. The fire was contained and put out by the fire department. We are needing everyone who has items in a storage locker in the laundry room to please remove the items from the locker as soon as possible today. This is required for cleaning purposes. Please let us know any questions or concerns you may have. Thank you. The new apartment reminded me and Lena of a hotel. It had a balcony and large east-facing windows looking out onto lush foliage and lots of natural light. We were happy. Our cat Satsuma was happy. We would later adopt our second cat named Tofu after a fire broke out in the laundry room beneath our apartment. They loved the 550 square foot one bed, one bath. We all did. We took Satsuma to the vet. It turned out that in her old age, she had developed kidney disease. The veterinarian kept referring to it as end-of-life care, which we found offensive. Sumi would live yet many more years. She and Tofu were inseparable, and they were the lights of our lives. 2 years after moving into the apartment, we heard rumblings of the university taking over the apartment building and making it exclusively for student housing. I was no longer a student, so we had to look for a new place. It would be in Englewood, Colorado.
Okay, great, go.
But I don't really wanna.
Go!
As we sat there, I couldn't help but think of her brother. How would we explain what we did? What needed to be? There's an innate human desire to explain things. Religion, academia, fucking smoke signals, I don't know. All used to explain what happens when we die, who invented the cotton gin, and help, respectively. So when a family member passes, and you aren't able to explain why your sister is gone and won't be coming back, there's not a word to describe that sadness. Assembling a piece of IKEA furniture, there's an unspoken assumption that you'll never disassemble it or fix it, and instead, when you move or it falls into a state of disrepair, then it's destined for the landfill. Such was my understanding anyway. Lena disagreed. She took that Billy bookcase apart, loaded it into the car, and showed up at the new place, ready and rearing to put it back together. I did offer to help reassemble, but she insisted on doing it herself. She ultimately completed it, and I anchored it to the wall, properly this time, very impressed with her. After adhering it to the wall, we noticed just one panel was facing the wrong direction, revealing the particle board in its full glory. Doesn't look too bad. Good job, Lena.
Can I ask you a question real quick?
You may.
All right, what would your response be to the prompt, are you out there?
Am I out there? Interesting.
What do you think, Stu? Can you say it into the microphone?
Yes.
What am I searching for?
Yeah, I'm 40 and I am still trying to figure that out.
I think I'm searching for
something life-changing.
Maybe like fulfillment?
I'm searching for myself.
I'm searching to make a connection. I have a picture of me 3 years old coming in through Miami. That look on my face, that little boy. I spend most of my time in Barbados on the beach. I take my ball wherever I go. So I take the ball, throw it, and as the wave and the wind take it, a white man ran from his hotel in Sirius, and he said to me, are you measuring the tidal wave and how the current flows and whether the moon is affecting? It's very hard place when I have to look at people and go, I'm playing. There's no right way to play with a ball. You just play. His joy, his energy, his excitement. I want to bring that more into my life. His creative energy. I want desperately to connect with that little boy inside me.
Have no idea what you want when you die.
My best guess is the Colorado now has this like water cremation where you can basically go back to the soil or act as fertilizer. The process of it is probably kind of gross, but I like the idea of being useful, and maybe if I could help plants grow or not just feel like I'm stuck somewhere, that you're in this box, you're not gonna go anywhere, the physical stuff is just stuck there. I don't like that idea. I like sort of dissolving into kind of nothingness or back to the soil and sort of regenerative ideas. Maybe if I was more of a diva or something, I would want some kind of ostentatious memorial. The rituals and the places we keep for death, it's really only for the living. To come and remember, to process out of gratitude for being alive, maybe. Have some catharsis when someone you love does die, then you can go through the motions of, okay, I'm in a special place for this, like, at least in our Western culture, you know, you can come and your feelings are valid. You don't have to be grieving in some place that's somehow unacceptable to our Western society. Grief is not linear. The way that we try to go through the motions of, you know, the 5 stages of grief, and now it's like 7 stages, or the, you know, anger and depression and reconstruction, they're not linear at all. You like cycle back on them, and feelings come up at the strangest moments, and maybe we just use places like cemeteries and gravestones and burial sites as the way to help us contain that grief. And to have some kind of record that, yes, this person was alive, we want to remember them, we want our lives to have value in some way. I was in Sweden on a residency a couple years ago, and I met this archaeologist who showed me this, essentially a grave site, but it was an archaeological dig site from the Roman Iron Age, so that's between 0 AD and 400 AD, almost 2,000 years ago. And it was a circle of stones that had in the middle of it like a big collection of larger, other different colored stones. And then underneath those rocks had been buried what my friend and his colleagues have found to be like a warrior. And around the warrior were nearly newborn children buried at different times, actually, at future centuries, they were buried there. And I just felt this odd need to process how I felt about this warrior and this archaeological site through music. That I don't know this person. I'm in Sweden. Like, I have no connection to a 2,000-year-old burial site, if not just a fascination with it. But I just felt this odd feeling of how do we keep this feeling in our minds, and how do we work through this odd feeling that someone died who must have been special, and there were children buried around him, and they must have been either probably taken from life too soon and given a special place next to this important person. We can only make guesses. You know, we don't know. There's not like a plaque from 2,000 years ago that describes what was all happening. But I realized, like, I think this needs to be a piece of music about grief. That I don't really have ways to talk about my own grief, and I haven't experienced a lot of it yet. And could I maybe make a piece that helps other people, gathers them together in kind of this time procession of piano music, or timelessness, as in like outside of time, like forever time. Maybe that's a helpful way for someone to understand grief or move through grief. There's so many feelings involved. It's very hard to untangle why I felt this way about that particular person. And maybe also it's, we're in the middle of Sweden on an island. It's misty and foggy, and, you know, it's so atmospheric that it feels like cinematic. And so you feel transported to this place that maybe you can kind of understand what was happening 2,000 years ago in some abstract way. And you feel things about it and want to try to understand it. There's some probably impetus when you get to be sort of super famous, like a sort of Tutankhamun's tomb, you know, covered in gold, precious gems, the ideas of the afterlife and wanting other people to realize how special you thought you were. And there's a little bit of that, even in this burial in Sweden of a circle of stones with limestone in the middle of it. They're really heavy, though. Someone has to do that intentionally, and someone has to think that that's going to be important for centuries to come. They're not going to spend all that effort without putting some kind of value on that person. The warrior piece is also kind of a strange piece, as if all my works were not strange. But it's basically a piece for two pianists, but only three hands. So there's a lot of piano works that are for two people, like two pianos or four hands, as in two people play at the same piano, and they just take different sides of the instrument. But my piece has three hands, and I just thought of there's a middle person, basically, a central person, let's call them player one, who they basically only play nearly one note the entire time of this, like, 11-minute piece. And I kind of thought of them as, like, maybe they are the person who has died. The person who's just there forever. It's like the ticking clock of forever time. But around them is pianist number two, and they actually play all the notes that are sort of around the other parts of the keyboard. Sometimes I feel like there's a way to connect with this person in the middle, the warrior pianist. And sometimes you feel really disconnected with that person or that player. So I wanted to make almost like this conceptual piece where you might walk around the piano and you play the top part and then you play the bottom part of the piano and you cycle around as like the years pass. But every once in a while, there's a moment where both of the pianists might have this like little moment of connection where you feel sort of one together. You feel as one in a way. And the very last note of the piece actually has both people playing the same note at the same time. So it's in a way like remembering an ancestor that you find this way to connect with people, even if it's in a different way than you expected, or over a long amount of time, like, we will still remember these people in some way, even if their original thoughts were far more abstract now. But that there is hopefully a kind of beauty in that too, in trying to connect with something that seems like it's in forever time. In the same way as Sufjan Stevens and Tori Amos and other musicians that we admire, like, we're trying to understand our feelings and process how do I interact with this thing that feels very foreign to me, and it makes me sad, but also it makes me feel nostalgic, but also it makes me feel connected to nature, and all of these really abstract things that are very hard to put into words. There's something so deeply connected to our feelings in music, which obviously sounds trite for me as a composer to say, but it really does connect with our deep-seated psyche. I think in a way that visual things or words or something cannot do by themselves. It's still a great mystery of life.
Hey, guess what? That's the end. I mean, not the end, but, you know, the end of the episode. Today we heard Disassembly Required, written and produced by Grayton Newman. Grayton is a Colorado-based multimedia artist primarily focused on narrative audio and photography. He is an alumnus of NPR's Next Generation Radio program and a Society of Professional Journalists award-winning podcast producer. You can visit his portfolio at greyhoundbrand.com or just follow the link in the show notes. Also, I have it on good authority that he is upgrading his furniture from IKEA to very, very heavy glass tables that barely fit in the back of my car and need to be carried up two flights of stairs. We then heard a short from Ramoy Philip. Ramoy is a New York-based creative that more than anything wants his headstone to read, "This dude made dope-ass shit," and "This dude was not corny." This piece also featured music from Chris Rapolo. Growing up in New York, music producer Chris Rapolo didn't just hear the city, he felt it. First in his ears, beating through his chest, and shooting out his fingertips straight into the keys. You can find more from Ramoy at ramoyphillip.com. And finally, we heard The Warrior, composed and talked about by Nathan Hall, produced and edited by me. Nathan is a composer and artist who explores site specificity, nature, sexuality, and personal identity. His works have been featured and exhibited in 16 countries and 24 U.S. states, and he is a former Fulbright Fellow to Iceland and a McKnight Visiting Composer. He is currently a Red Line resident artist and teaches music composition and music production at the University of Denver and at REMCAD. He lives in Denver, Colorado, with his husband, Andy. And I may have been and may continue to be Josh. And I have two more things to say to you. First, if you would like to participate in this little zine experiment show thing, you should reach out to me. I have the email, josh@rocketfromearth.com. Write things to me. Write them. Also, if you are listening all the way to the very end, like I know you are, you should tell a few people, but not too many people, about this show. It would be kind of neat if a few more people listened. Anyway, that's it. I will yap at you in a couple of weeks. Goodbye.
That Grand Canyon hippie love-in is all washed up. For one thing, sponsors were afraid of what might happen when border guards in Arizona found the usual supply of dope that follows such a crowd, not to mention peyote plants. And besides, there's no food or water facilities within 80 miles of the proposed place.
Well, all it was generally considered that it was an unwise undertaking at this time. And everyone was grateful that the thing has been called off.
Meanwhile, L.A. County supervisors are worried that such activities as Digger's Free Food Service at Ferndale will attract Frisco hippies. That would be, in the words of Supervisor Debs, outrageous.